Welcome, everyone, and thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way we think about and experience our world. Today is March 17th, 2017, so happy St. Patrick's Day. On today's show, we will be discussing A Course in Miracles with writer, web designer, and ACIM teacher Bruce Rawls. And our focus for today, if you want to pull out your books, we're going to be referring to ACIM Workbook Lesson 136, which is Sickness is a Defense Against the Truth. And one of the ideas that we're going to pull out of there that we're going to be talking about is something called the Double Shield of Oblivion. Now, I know that sounds very complicated, and indeed, the ego does a lot to, you know, a lot of mental gymnastics to convince us that it is pretty, you know, complicated, and there's no way around it. But it's really kind of simple once we start talking about it, like a lot of things in life. So that is what we're going to talk about today, and hopefully we won't lose you with those kinds of concepts and words. And speaking of discussion, you can join us in another way. In addition to just listening to the show today, you can actually go over to Facebook and you can join us in our private group where you can ask questions or you can make comments, sort of join in the discussion. And if you've never been over there, the way you can find that group is to go first to our website, which is 12radio.com. And when you go there, you're going to see on the left side of the page, there's a number of options. One of those options is chat. And when you click on chat, you will be redirected to Facebook where you can ask to join our private group, and then you can come in and make your comments or your questions. So go ahead and do that today if you'd like to. You don't need to. You can just sit back and listen today. But if you want to ask a question or make a comment, you can do it that way. So welcome, Bruce. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you, CA. Always a joy and a pleasure to be on your show.
Yes, and thank you for the suggestion. I'm always intrigued by what people come up with, what they want to talk about. So now what led you to these particular topics today?
Well, I've talked about them before, but it's been a while. And I just think they're such a this double shield of oblivion idea is such a useful concept. It's only mentioned once in those terms in the course, which is in the fifth paragraph of Workbook Lesson 136. Which I suppose we could read. But the concept, before we do, the concept of the double shield of oblivion is all through the course. And basically, to quickly summarize, I suppose we could say that the outer shield is the world and the inner shield is the ego's thought system. And those are the two things that you know, we use to keep ourselves, while following ego's dictates anyway, mindless and dumb and unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
and that's basically, you know, the insanity of the ego's thought system is it, you know, as Ken Wapnick says, is it, you know, a maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem. But I mean, it's just a really, I think, a helpful concept. I actually drew a little diagram in the bottom of my copy of the course, and I made like a little sphere within a sphere, and then the inner shield is this the ego's whole thought system of, you know, sin, guilt, fear, denial of truth, of course, basically a denial of reality, a denial of the God self, if you will, that we all share, and it does that in an insane way by having us believe that we actually pulled off the fragmentation of perfect oneness. We in some crazy dream that we've all become so accustomed to, we've adopted the idea that it was possible for us to shatter perfect oneness, throw God under the bus, whatever metaphor you want to use, but somehow we were able to destroy a peace and an innocence that transcends anything that we can imagine in this world. And in order to further that, because we think that it's something we need to escape from, which of course that idea is completely unfounded, but we don't know that until we look at it, we went to a second length. The first line of defense of the mind wasn't enough, so we thought, well, let's have, you know, the inner secret, if you will, that is not true. It wasn't sufficient, so let's make up another one to make sure we stay out of our mind where that nasty, you know, that those nasty thoughts of guilt and sin and fear and all that stuff that we don't want to look at, even though they're unfounded, let's make up a whole defensive strategy that will ensure that we keep so busy we don't ever think to open that dusty cobweb-laden trap door to the inner recesses of our mind and discover that ego's raison d'être, is that how you say the
yes.
being? its whole purpose for existence is basically to run away from a problem that never happened. But we made up a world. We not just a little Hollywood sci-fi movie. We watched Passengers last night with some friends, and that was kind of interesting. But you know, they're on a spaceship, you know, traveling, you know, what, 120 years at part of the speed of light to colonize a new planet. You know, I think I can say that without giving too much of the plot away. But you know, the lengths that we go to make up an entire world. Well, they made up a world to get between worlds, but we made up a whole cosmology. We made up everything from subatomic quarks to, you know, supermassive quasars and galactic clusters and everything in between. You know, we outdid ourselves in a sense, making up this thing that is so convincing with the special effects that are so, you know, razzle dazzle and mind boggling that we believe it. We think this is the real deal. And that's exactly what ego wants us to do, is to identify with and to participate in, an identity that doesn't work for us.
Mm-hmm.
So how about if I read that fifth paragraph?
Sure.
And then we can talk about it. Or do you want to read it?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So this is from lesson 136, which is sickness is a defense against the truth. And that alone is plenty of, you know, in that rather lengthy lesson, there's a lot about, you know, the body's health and well-being versus when it doesn't seem to be functioning. But that's actually, in a sense, a subcategory in some ways of the overall theme, which I think the double shield of oblivion gives us a clue into how we can generalize this lesson. So I'll go ahead and read this fifth paragraph.
Okay.
It is this quick forgetting of the part you play in making your quote reality unquote that makes defenses seem to be beyond your own control. But what you have forgot can be remembered given willingness to reconsider the decision, which is, and here we go, doubly shielded by oblivion. Your remembering is but the sign that this decision still remains in force as far as your desires are concerned. So there's will and intention again, as it weaves its way throughout the course. Mistake not this for fact. Defenses must make facts unrecognizable. It's ego's alternative facts, right?
Right.
They aim at doing this, and it is this they do. So there we have it. You know, that's basically, you know, an example of where in the course we're urged to consider very gently, but we're, you know, encouraged to consider that just maybe, we've made decisions for a world to hide a thought system that is equally untrue and unreal and unfounded that don't serve us. And, you know, but we don't have to defend them. If we were willing to look at them, and then if we're willing to look at them, we basically, you know, lower those shields, to use a Star Trek metaphor, and voila, when we do that, we see right through ego's facades, and the peace and the innocence and the unchanging integrity happiness, really, that we all thought we had forsaken is there waiting for us patiently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, What are your thoughts on this?
These are my thoughts, and I don't want to go too far astray, but to me, I guess I feel like there are so many examples in my personal life which, you know, just speak to this. And several times, mm-hmm. I mean, for me, many times it's been about being involved in meetings. And mm-hmm. specifically, in fact, I was just reminding somebody of this the other day. We were talking, and I may have shared this on the show before, but I worked in the corporate world for a long time, so uh-huh. I was in a lot of meetings. And one time we were discussing an issue, you know, the managers of a department, we were all sitting around, you know, discussing where we were going in the future and blah, blah, blah. Well, somebody had brought up something that they weren't really happy that I wasn't abiding by what they considered to be the rules. And they said, well, will you abide by the rules in the future? And I said, well, I'll think about it. Well, at the point I said that, literally one of the people stood up from the table. He was so angry. And he said, you don't get to think about it. It's a rule. You don't get to think about it. And I said, but wait a minute. I said, two things. One, you know, we always get to think about it because if I break the rules, then I have to suffer the consequences. I said, but the really important issue here to me is we sat at this table a year ago and we made the rule. And so you know, it's like, if the rule isn't working for us, can't we reconsider?
Uh-huh.
And he's like, but it's the rule. And I said, but we made the rule. And I will admit, everybody on their faces, they were like, to me, that is the double shield. It's like the ego makes up this lie, or it makes up all these stories, and then it uses the very story to defend what, you know, that's the truth. And it's like, but no, you can't defend the truth with what you made up. So, you know, and that was a perfect example of, you know, they just were incredulous that I would ever question the rules, forgetting that we made up the rules.
Yeah, which actually ties in beautifully with today's workbook lesson for those who are doing it chronologically, which I've been doing again this year. I'm under no laws but God's, you know, and which is, I think, that's a eloquent restatement of that, you know, suggests that all the rules that the ego has made up, that don't serve us, if we're honest with ourselves, are in a sense meant to be broken. It doesn't suggest that we, you know, on the level of form, behaviorally break rules of the road and you know, run red lights.
Right.
And, you know, it's not talking that kind of craziness. It's just basically saying that the laws that of the ego that are really underlying the laws of the world are the ones that we need to examine. And it's always and only about the mind, as we know from listening to, you know, wonderful commentaries by Kenneth Wapnick, and that this course represents. So if it's always and only about the mind, then we can say, well, what laws am I really, you know, where am I enforcing laws and regulations of the ego's dictum and its mandates that are keeping me enslaved and needlessly to you know, a thought system that doesn't serve me.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, and in this lesson too, you know, like as you said, they bring in the body a lot,
mm-hmm.
and but part of that reasoning is just saying, yeah, you make up a body, and then you use the body as your proof that
right.
you're not divine.
Exactly.
And, you know,
exactly.
You know, so you get all caught up going, well, I've got to have a body because I can feel it. I can feel the pain or I can feel the pleasure. So I've got to be something other than divine because here's this body. Here's my proof. And we just once again forget that we made it up to prove it to ourselves.
Exactly. The circular, classic circular, you know, reasoning, the circular logic that the ego revels in, and yet there's no basis for it. But because it's so pervasive, and we have so many reinforcements in the world, including all the hired actors on our cast who will, you know, at the drop of a hat support our victimhood and our woes sure, you, that's right, you have every right to feel justifiably angry, you know, for this thing that befell you with your body or your finances or your political system or your, you know, yada, you know, your relationships with XYZ, you know, whether it's people or things or whatever, environment, doesn't matter. It's all, perfectly planned in this sort of sinister Machiavellian plot of the ego to keep us enslaved. But all we have to do is just notice that the door to the mind is always open. It's like, oh, I thought that was locked and welded shut. And then, no, it's just, you know, the doors open and there's light, you know, peeking out from behind it, and we could walk through whenever we want.
Right, and yet it is so difficult. That's it. It is difficult because I've got all this proof.
Yeah, I think a part of the reason why it's difficult, well, I'm going to hark back to, you know, a sci-fi movie that I watched last night, is you think of all the effort we go to make up the world mostly an unconscious level, but even just in our everyday lives, you know, you look at all the stuff I look at all the stuff that I do to make this elaborate set of things I want to accomplish, and, you know, arranging things in my house and my world and my life and my computer and everything else the way I want them, because I think that that's going to somehow pay off and make me happy. Well, just, you know, to any of those examples could be example enough to remind us that all those things, no matter how elaborate we've set them up, ultimately are not the key to peace. They're not what really is our gateway to happiness, because those externals can change. And on some level, that, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, we know that the script was written to keep us forever mindless, to keep us forever dodging and scrambling to try to fix the issues with the world that we made up. So this movie last night was, you know, certainly another good example is, you know, that here they are going through space and lo and behold, something happens to the ship and it starts malfunctioning and, you know, anyway, but, you know, if you see this movie called Passengers, you'll see what I mean, which is basically that you know, they went to incredible lengths to make this world that was, you know, just every bell and whistle you could think of. But that's what we've done with this world. We've gone to extreme lengths to make up a better than Disneyland, better than any special effects sci-fi film, holographic movie, a 3D movie that has all five senses and depth out to cosmic proportions and inward to microscopic, microcosmic proportions and everything in between and with biology and physics and all these arts and sciences and things that make it seem so real. And you know, there's nothing wrong with enjoying those things, but I think the real brilliance happens when we choose to look at the contents of our mind and go past that outer shield of oblivion, which is the world, and get back to the uncomfortable thoughts and look at those and see that those uncomfortable thoughts, what the Course calls Ken Wapnick actually calls it the unholy trinity of sin, guilt, fear. Mm-hmm. It's the whole thought system of death, destruction, and doom and gloom that is really at the heart of ego's self-concept and self-image, is that it believes that on some level or another, there's a separate self that has a body that's his poster child, and that is really what we're stuck in. That's the law that we're trying to abide by as egos, you know, and don't speak up in that meeting against that, or you'll have plenty of people to shut you down, you know?
Yeah.
But that meeting is really metaphorically just a way of looking at the opportunities we have in any situation, whether it's a work situation, a family situation, you know, any situation, to look at our minds and see that there's options. Shall I read a little of the several pages that Ken Wapnick wrote about?
Yes.
This is from The Journey Home, The Obstacles to Peace and A Course in Miracles. And it's one of Ken's books that I've just finally started reading recently. But I got to this section. I thought, well, what a great time to revisit this idea of the double shield of oblivion. So on page 13 of that book, he talks about defense one. This would be the inner shield of oblivion. The secret dream of sin, guilt, and fear. Once the decision was made for the wrong mind, the ego has the Son of God right where it wants him, identified with it and with it alone, and now seeks to ensure that the situation will always remain that way. The ego thus begins to set into motion its plan of ensuring that the son will never be able to change his mind. It proceeds by telling the Son of God the following. I have good news and bad news. That was a setup. Huh?
Yeah, I love the way Ken writes.
Oh, me too, me too. The good news is that we're finally free of the tyrannical rule of God. Yeah, right. We have won our freedom and independence, our autonomy, and our power to create on our own. Indeed, we have everything we always dreamed of having. And it is true. It is all ours. Yeah, there's the authority problem, right?
Yeah.
why don't I just read on the next paragraph? Your freedom, the ego continues, is the good news. The bad news is that I neglected to tell you of one piece of information, which, in fairness to you, you should know about. Your newly won freedom has come at a great price. In order to win your individuality, you had to destroy God, crucify Christ, and shatter the wholeness of heaven, because unity and separation cannot coexist. As a quick aside, the other day I was giving another talk, and I was actually at a unity church here in Oregon, and I was thinking, what's the opposite of unity? Well, duality. And then a little light bulb moment's like, well, where does that word occur in our language? Well, it's part of the word individuality. So there's a clue, isn't it? I mean, that's how we, you know, that's our poster child of duality, is our individuality. Okay. So then he goes on and says, if the oneness of God is the truth, then our individuality has no place to be and cannot stand. On the other hand, if our individuality is reality, then God's oneness is a lie and he does not exist. And so we had no choice but to kill God and his true son, Christ. Well, these are, of course, metaphors, but that's the world that we think we live in. We think we live in a world where we killed off perfect oneness, killed off reality. So pretty crazy, huh?
Yeah. Well, and in that next paragraph, I mean, what I've got highlighted in my book is where it says, you know, this is bringing out the whole idea of one or the other. It's
yep.
either you or me.
Do you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Okay.
At least I think, I didn't skip, did I?
No.
Okay.
No.
This statement of the ego reflects the all-important principle of its thought system. One or the other. One becomes weak, the other strong by this defeat, as seen in the description of the special relationship. But once again, I just love that. I mean, you know, the simplicity once again of it. It's me or you. One or the other. And that's what the ego system is banking on.
Right.
Is that we always see it as either you win or I win, which then goes to the special relationship, because in the special relationship, whether or not it's special love or it's special hate, it's always, are you going to give me what I want?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
as long as
you do, Bruce, I'd love you. And as long as yeah. you don't, I hate you.
Well, that's it. That's it. It's a my way or the highway, win-lose. You know, lose-win strategy. Of course, anything that's win-lose or lose-win is really lose-lose, because if unity is truth, if oneness is truth, then the idea of partial winning or partial success really is just, a dysfunctional dream. So the my way or the highway, the we, they thinking, ultimately is problematic and dysfunctional, because it suggests that that minds aren't joined and that things can be disconnected from each other, but which mm-hmm. is in truth or not. And even physics tells us that everything's just one thing, but we have conveniently separated the oneness into these molecules and atoms that appear to be, you know, multitudinous.
Yes. And by the way, I want to mention the book that we've been reading from is called The Journey Home, mm-hmm. The Obstacles to Peace in A Course in Miracles by Ken Wapnick. And I'll tell you what, this one, when you said to me, oh, do you have that book? I said, oh, do I have that book? Because I love this book and have referred to it so many times that I've had to kind of patch the front cover together.
Well, I just picked up a copy a couple of years ago when they had the 2-for-1 sale at the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. And I finally now just, you know, cracked it a few days ago. So it's like, it's been haunting me to read.
Well, I mean, personally, I think you're going to love it. I really do. The other thing, and I've told people this before, I mean, a lot of people do this, but I read with highlighters mm-hmm. and stickers. And so I always have stars, you know, pages of those stars like teachers use. And so when something's really good, I put a star next to it. Mm-hmm. And this book, literally, if you flip through it, almost every single page is covered with stars. So it becomes, well, it becomes kind of silly because it's like, okay, that's really, really good. Okay, wait a minute. This is really, really good. And so then when I'm going back trying to find a really, really good passage, it's like I really can open to almost any page because that's how it felt when I was reading it. Like, oh my God, this is incredible. Oh my God, this is incredible. So I think you're really, really going to like the book. It's just, I mean, to me, there's a couple of his that I just thought were unbelievably good. And this is one of them.
He seems to reiterate in uniquely distinctive ways, the same truth over and over, but he does it in such brilliant and engaging ways that I never tire of reading it, even though it's on the level of truth, infinitely repetitious, but he manages to craft it with equal, genius and clarity and in a way that is always engaging. So.
Well, he absolutely does. And I think some of these ideas, like I will admit, you know, in the very, very beginning, I resisted Ken. And partially, I guess, because he was such an intellectual and it seemed so high, you know, like even this, the obstacles to peace. And if you read the chapters in A Course in Miracles with the obstacles to peace, I think those are very, very difficult chapters.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, you know, our natural psychology, we just want to resist it.
Right,
and yet
of course.
Ken breaks it down into this is what this means and this is how it works in our lives. And you go, oh yeah. You know, so he really does take these difficult or, you know, once again, like the double shield of oblivion, you know, he takes some of those ideas and just says, okay, guys, this is what it is. This is what it feels like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like those passages you read that were pretty funny. Okay, here's what the ego is saying. And he makes it very understandable. Whereas I think a lot of us would tend to just go, okay, that was tough. I think I'll skip over that chapter. You know, I think I'll just forget those obstacles to peace. Who needs to look at that? Where it's vital stuff and it's core. But as you said too, you know, in a sense, the course repeats and repeats and repeats over and over. You know, the ideas are the same over and over, just maybe they're said differently. And like even in this lesson, 136, it says, do not be confused about what must be healed. Mm-hmm. And how many times do we hear that in the course? This is a course in undoing those misconceptions of the mind. It's the mind that needs to be healed, not necessarily the body. Even though once again, people go, what? You know, but it's like, do not be confused about what's really wrong here. Do not be confused about what must be healed.
Exactly. I mean, when you phrase it in terms like, you know, it's not necessary to heal what never existed. It kind of seems obvious, but mm-hmm. that's not how our mind thinks most of the time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yet I think we do understand it on, once again, if we look at our lives and we use them as the curriculum, we get it. Like how many of us do say things like, what's the point? Even if we're talking totally on the level of physical, mm-hmm. how many times do we look at what we're doing and go, okay, I'm trying to treat symptoms. I'm not treating the cause. You know, maybe a classic case would be, let's say you have some kind of digestive disorder and certain kinds of foods make your stomach hurt. So you take one of those pills so that you can still eat the food. Now, I'm not blaming, but what we're doing is we're treating the symptom rather than treating the cause.
Exactly.
And we know that on a physical level that we do that all the time because it's easier. I'd rather pop an aspirin than figure out why I've got a headache. Right. You know, or, you know, drink more caffeine or whatever it is. I want to do what I want to do and then treat the symptoms if they're unfortunate. And so, but when we take that a step deeper, we realize it's the same kind of thing. We would so much rather figure out why is our body sick or why is this happening to me or why am I a victim in the world than to really look at the mind or to look at why we think these things are true.
Exactly.
You know,
it's an inconvenient truth that we run away from. But ultimately, I think we recognize that it's just silly to keep trying to be a fugitive from the peace that we really want. Even though we don't usually think of it that way.
And yet, you know, once again, I would draw people's attention. This lesson is really, really long. And, mm-hmm. and yet it's wonderful. It's just full of wonderful things. But what I like is when we get towards the end of it, it actually says, if you let your mind harbor attack thoughts, yield to judgment, or make plans against uncertainties to come, you have again misplaced yourself. And the reason I like that is because as we're getting towards the end of this lesson and he's kind of laid all this stuff out, he goes, oh, and by the way, you know what? Today, in this moment, you can change your mind. You can do it right now. But then reminds us, but if you're also participating in these things, if you let your mind harbor attack thoughts, if you yield to judgment, or if you're constantly making plans to protect yourself against something that you think is going to happen in the future, then once again, you've forgotten and you think you're a body all over again. And so I like those clarities. You know, I like those things because, we forget that, you know, it's like the person walking down the street who keeps falling into the pothole. And so I love that he's going, okay, guys, by the way, this is what the potholes look like. You know, it's when it's those attack thoughts and those judgments.
Right. It's like the pothole looks like. Yeah. I think practicing forgiveness and doing the curriculum of the course where we become more mindful is almost like installing software in our mind that brings up a little, heads up display, you know, kind of like the sci-fi movies I was watching yesterday. Where we see a pothole ahead, you know, little red, you know, translucent letters across the screen of our mind kind of thing. And we don't have to go through the Ned Ryerson scene thousands of times on the Groundhog Day movie.
Yes.
You know, but whatever works, you know, maybe we do need, we need to go through that so many times. But I think the idea of the course, one of the key concepts, which is why the most important, you know, well not, again, it's not the most important, but it really encapsulates all the other principles is that there's no order of difficulty among them as far as miracles go. And that's right at the very first sentence in the text. Because it's basically suggesting that we can learn to generalize. We can learn to see that once you've applied it to some things, you can continue to apply it. And I like the three examples you gave from, you know, toward the end of this workbook lesson, because those are all really good practical things to look for. You know, am I being judgmental? Am I making plans to protect from, you know, adversity and so forth? All those things can be really helpful to, you know, like little warning messages flashing on the screen or just the memory of having tried that enough times that we avoid the pothole and Ned Ryerson doesn't have anything to laugh at.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But, yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say maybe we could read some more of that, that section if in the journey home if you wanted to or you.
Okay. Do you want me to pick up right where I was?
Oh, sure. Why not?
Okay. Well, what I was reading was that little intro where it says, you know, one or the other and as seen in the description of the special relationship. So then he goes on to say, to substitute is to accept instead. If you would but consider exactly what this entails, you would perceive at once how much at variance this is with the goal of the Holy Spirit or the goal the Holy Spirit has given you and would accomplish for you. To substitute is to choose between renouncing one aspect of the sonship in favor of the other. For this special purpose, one is judged more valuable and the other is replaced by him. The relationship in which the substitution occurred is thus fragmented and its purpose split accordingly. To fragment is to exclude. And substitution is the strongest defense the ego has for separation. And that comes from actually the text, chapter 18.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just going into that, the principle of one or the other.
Right. As you were reading that, see, what crossed my mind is if a substitution is made, and in the course of the context that the substitution is always substituting something unreal, we're basically telling ourselves this crazy yet silly and forgivable idea that I'm going to settle for essentially nothing because anything that doesn't exist in eternity is really nothing and has no true reality. So anytime we settle for some of the ego's blather in our mind, you know, regardless of whether it seems to be the inner or outer shield of oblivion, it's something that it's a thought or something in the world that we think is going to make us happy. We're basically saying, I'm willing to give up everything for nothing. I'm willing to, you know, compromise with this substitute experience. And instead of the peace that I know is beyond there on some level. Now, we're not consciously aware of that peace, I think, very often. But I think there's something within all of us, that, and I strongly suspect that anybody listening to this conversation will have that understanding. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been drawn to, you know, explore this kind of information. Because, you know, but intrinsically, everyone really has that awareness, however deeply buried or hidden, seemingly. Because we all know that there really is, on some level, an awareness that brings us home. And I think that's what this really suggests, is that we have to look at the substitutes, though, in order to go beyond them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that is so perfect, that why do we even do that? Why do we substitute nothing, as you said, nothing for everything?
Right. But it's usually the jargon that the ego uses. Well, it doesn't even acknowledge truth, so there's no idea of second best. But it's always a mediocre alternative, because the ego has no cognizance or no understanding of truth, and by definition, it was this very, you know, foundation, which is unfounded, is based on the idea that separation is possible. So the idea of perfect oneness, or a oneness joined as one, as the Course puts it, doesn't even register with the ego mind. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, we think that, you know, there's just choices among, bad, poor, and worse. You know, we don't really even have an idea of what the good is, you know, in a non-dual, non-comparative sense. Because we're so enamored with the world that we made up, and thinking that there's something yet, you know, some combination of circumstances or situations or people or places or things or whatever that is going to make us happy.
Mm-hmm. You know, we never give up hope, do we?
No. It's like Charlie Brown in the football every year. You know, it's like, well, there's this time Lucy's going to hold it, and I won't go whoomp on my back. You know. You know. When she
talk about a special
away.
Relationship.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, we keep doing it over and over because we keep thinking, well, we change the props, we change the stage lighting and the set decorations, and we think, oh, now it's going to be all different because I've got this, you know, new stuff and whatever that stuff is. But it's still the same motivation and the same, resistance and the same authority problem to thinking that what I made on my own is going to make me happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and once again, you know, those three things that are at the end of this lesson, that so resonated with me when I read it, mm-hmm. you know, that making plans against uncertainties to come.
Yes.
And because, you know, it's not that we shouldn't save money. It's not that we shouldn't look at the future, but it just so resonated that we live our lives that way, going, well, I'm going to protect, this can't happen to me, or this can't happen to me, or if, you know, I'm going to take care of this so this can never happen to me. And you know what? It's just that reinforcement that we do feel fairly, you know, helpless because we're not in control of
right.
the future.
Right.
And that is just such a crazy place to be and an uncomfortable place to be. And I think
right.
about all the things we do to guarantee that those negative, unhappy things will ever happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't do it. I mean, because in fact, in a sense, the ego is set up to make sure it will happen.
Right, right.
You know, yeah. I mean, the yeah. ego's going to keep us dancing as long as it can.
As long as there's a we and a they, or a subject and an object, as long as there's a duality to our thinking, we're not going to be happy with that outcome.
Right.
And I think The third item of those three, yielding to judgment, making plans against uncertainties. The first one, though, is one that's sometimes more subtle, but other times not so much. But I think it's an equally vital one, the attack thoughts, harboring attack thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at the ways in which we do that and how often those arise during the day, if we're honest with ourselves, we'd realize that, wow, it's a 24/7 shitstorm, basically.
Yes.
Of ego blather that comes at us from our own choice to want to become, be a victim and or a victimizer. You know, in either case, we're not going to be peaceful with that. We're not going to feel at ease with that, position and that role that we've taken on, which is again a substitution for the awareness that we're all in it together. And I think that's a vital way of remembering that how we can get out of this mental quagmire is by looking for the very practical approach of shared interest, realizing that we're all in it for the same ultimate purpose, which is to, you know, go home together, as Ken's book title suggests, The Journey Home. So if we can remember that if we express kindness and, you know, do whatever seems to be helpful on the level of form, motivated, and it's not that what we do, but it's the motivation behind it of I am no better or worse, less or greater than any other seemingly separate self or individual, because we're all in it together on the same boat. That can be hugely helpful for getting back to the mind, going past that, in other words, going past that outer shield of oblivion and going back to the inner shield and saying, well, that whole thought system of sin, guilt, and fear can be undone by focusing on, making it about the other person, as Ken says, or the shared interest idea of seeing to it that, I am a better listener and let people know that I'm involved with, that I really do want them to be happy and in a very sincere way, recognizing that really is the essence of all of us and that we all have that. And I love how Ken says, you know, we all have this tripartite system in our mind is the decision-making faculty, and the ego thought system, which is 100% insane, and the Holy Spirit's thought system, which I like, you know, kindness teacher or Jesus of the Course, whatever metaphor you like, which is always 100% sane. And we're always choosing between those two moment to moment. And we do that so quickly and so rapidly back and forth that we don't even notice when we've dropped the sword, picked up the sword, dropped the sword, picked up the sword.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and as you're talking, when you were talking about the movies, if you think about it, what kind of movies do we really love? Or what kind of movies do we think are really the greatest? And some of those are certainly what I would put in the genre of horror movies.
Oh, sure.
Where just
sure.
When you think the bad guy's dead, just when you think, you know, whatever, he reaches up from the grave or he reaches, you know, he's laying on the floor and he reaches up and grabs the ankle or whatever it is. Mm. We love, you know, we secretly love that idea that we're going to be shocked. We're going to be surprised and it's never going to be over. You know, I mean, every once in a while I'm watching just like a regular show, you know, like NCIS or something like that. And it's only 30 minutes into the show and they've caught the bad guy. Right. And I'm like, okay, there's a surprise coming because they don't end the show at 30 minutes, right? But a lot of times, you know, the really good movies are when you don't see the surprise coming, when you don't see the guy coming back from the dead or, you know, whatever. And, but we thrill to those kinds of movies. And when you think about it, we thrill to them because we're sick.
Exactly.
We're just sick.
Yeah, and it's a forgivable sick though, because
we
chose to be sick. Shall I read a little bit of the next section,
yes.
Defense 2? Because I think it might, since we're just doing an overview here of the double shield of oblivion. So the first one is really the shield of the mind, which is basically the ego strategy to keep us mindless by forever, you know, avoiding going in the mind in the first place. And the way it does that is through the outer shield of oblivion or the public dream rather than the secret dream, so to speak. So Ken talks about this in the next section, which he calls Defense Part 2, the world's dream of the body. And he goes, and so again, the ego has the son right where it wants him. Now even more so, the son of God is not only separated from his creator and source, but also fearful, which places him in the position where he must again turn to the ego for help. The ego, of course, is more than happy to oblige, for it does have a solution which logically follows from its construction of the problem. Made up problem.
Yeah, really.
It has convinced the son that the mind is now a battleground, and a most dangerous one at that. You know, there's the horror story, the twist at the end. Moreover, the ego made it very clear to him that there was no hope for his survival if he remained within his mind. His death at the hands of a wrathful, vengeful God being beyond question. Well, that's certainly, you know, set up in the inner shield of oblivion, and what we, where we try to escape from is egos. Thus, the stage is set for the final part of the ego's strategy for protecting its existence by rendering impotent the mind of God's son. I'll just read a little more. The ego tells the son that it has a brilliant plan that will enable him to keep his individuality, but not to have to pay any price for it. In other words, the ego's plan will be to allow the son to keep the separation he stole from God, but not the sin, which will be given away to another. This is how this part of the ego strategy develops. And it's basically the whole thing of, you know, projection and, you know, making the other, the victimizer and ourself the victim, and all those kind of strategies of, you know, making other things in the world, you know, the scapegoat instead of seeing that it's a projection.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know what I was kind of thinking as you said that too. Once again, the example in the world is the whole concept of marketing, especially to get us to buy things.
Mm-hmm.
Here's your problem, and this is how we're going to solve it.
Right, right.
And but first you have to buy into that you've got the problem.
Yeah.
And then guess what? I've got a solution.
Right, right. And that kind of ties into there's a lecturer named David Icke who talks about how, you know, the governments and political you know, strategist or well versed in this is basically make up a problem and then propose the solution which plays right into that problem, and sure enough it seems like a good idea, you know, if as long as you can buy the incorrect assumption, which of course it fits in beautifully with Ken's, you know, classic phrase that he thought was his best phrase, which I think is pretty brilliant too, is it's a maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. And we have like hundreds of examples of how we do that. You know, like all that search for weapons of, what were they calling? Weapons of mass destruction,
mm-hmm.
You know, and talk about distractions. We, you know, we're more than willing to always come up with a distraction to keep us from really looking at anything real.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Call off the Air National Guard because the sky is falling, you know.
Right.
A feather fell on Chicken Little's head, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, it's that kind of thing that the entire universe though is an overreaction. It's basically, that's what Ken and the course are telling us here, is that, you know, we made up an entire cosmos. And that's mm-hmm. kind of a lot to take on. But I think if we do it a little at a time, if we just look at each little thing that comes up and ask ourselves using the lessons in the workbook of A Course in Miracles as our, you know, a very helpful mechanism for getting back to the mind, we see that each angle that the ego tries to come at us with, can be undone by equal mindfulness that says, I see your bluff and I'm calling you on it, and I'm looking at the specific situation in the world, whether it's a, you know, in like the case of lesson 136, you know, it's an issue with my body, or it could be, you know, a financial one, or it could be a relationship one, or, you know, it could be any sort of thing in the world that seems to be involving something outside myself. If myself little s is defined as a body or a persona with a body, either way it's still separate, and if there's that separation, then the external situation is always going to be something that I'm at the mercy of, and as long as we buy into that, the ego's again, you know, just has this little, you know, fiendish grin on its face. It's like, aha, gotcha again. But don't look at the mind, because if you challenge that basic assumption that this is your identity, that yourself is this little less self that has a name and a and you know, a freshly reissued passport in my case, and a driver's license that isn't much older, and you know, all that stuff that says, oh, this is who I am. Well, no, that's what an accumulated system of beliefs that I've made up about this story that is no better or worse than any other story, but it's equally untrue, as they all are. But there really is a truth behind all of us that is the same, and that's that essence that we get to by looking at the shared interests and seeing that the outer shield of differences and substitutions and victimhoods and being at the mercy of things can be undone by choosing the teacher of mercy, the teacher that is gently forgiving of that misunderstanding and gets us back into the mind with a tremendous sigh of relief and a lot of comfort when we just look at it. We look at each situation and say, oh, that thing I was really sweating, or really troubled over or really upset about, you know, if after I slept on it or gave it a few years or decades, now that big problem that I thought was insurmountable, I realized was nothing, you know, in hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we can extrapolate and generalize and apply that hindsight to things that we seem to be enmeshed in and immersed in now, that can give us, you know, with practice, the ability to generalize and say, oh, well, this too shall pass. And therefore, whatever confronts me at any given moment is amenable to the Course in Miracles, forgiveness practice and seeing, differences ultimately unimportant, but the sameness and the shared interests is being important.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and on that note, I want to mention something from the chat room and then ask you for announcements. But Renee says that she is almost finished reading the geometry code that you wrote.
Oh.
And she said, so Bruce, thank you very much for a very helpful book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Really appreciate that feedback. Yeah.
Yeah. And do you have any other announcements that you'd like to make?
Gosh, not a whole lot. I think it's always a good time to remind people that there's, other than I have a little website, acimblog.com, the two main sites about the course that I always encourage people to go to are acim.org, which is the Foundation for Inner Peace, and facim.org, which is the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. And those two websites have just a tremendous depth and breadth of information about the course. And anyway, there's lots of great stuff online elsewhere too, of course. But I always like to, you know, encourage people to check out those two sites and support those organizations.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I was typing.
I heard.
I know. Sorry about that.
I
was putting your blog into the chat room. So people, as you're listening, it is acimblog.com, but you can, if you want to go back and check that in the chat room, it's there for you. And also, of course, the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. Just a wonderful plethora of information and available resources there. So anything else before we close the show today?
Well, there's some upcoming things, but I'll wait till a future show so then they'll already be existing things when I talk about them. How's that sound?
Okay, great.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for being
thank
here.
Thank you, Sia. It was a pleasure, and I always look forward to the next one, too.
Yeah, me too. And I also want to thank Scott Weaver, who is our producer today. And I also want to encourage you to stay tuned because there's lots of live programming coming up here on Friday on 1-2 Radio. And especially because it is St. Patrick's Day, Anita Ahuja is actually hosting a special edition of 1-2 Originals today, and it's devoted to St. Patrick's Day Celtic wisdom and inspiration. I believe that's at 11 a.m. Pacific and 2 Eastern today. You can always check the schedule over at 12radio.com. But I think that's right. So thank you so much for being here. We do have a sale going on over at 12listen.com. So if you kind of want to check in and get some advice or some Celtic wisdom from one of our advisors, we're going to be there today celebrating St. Patrick's Day and celebrating you, really. So thank you so much for being here. And until next week, I hope that you relax and wear loose clothes. You have been listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks and with my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.